Opportunity and for this wonderful workshop. What I'm going to talk about is not as philosophical as it seems from the title. Is a bunch of work, some already out, some still ongoing in collaboration with these people. And what I would like to show is the implication of special relativity into condensed matter systems. So obviously, as we saw in this workshop, the use of non-relativistic Lagrangians is ubiquitous in condensed matter systems at finite density. However, the very simple and possible only input from high energy physics that I would like to give is that at the end of the day, as far as we know, all fundamental physical interactions are relativistic, are Lorentz invariant, which implies that Lorentz symmetry is always broken spontaneously in the real world. So by the state of the system and not by the and not by the theory itself. So the theory is always fully relativistic invariant. In particular, Lorentz doesn't necessarily mean Lorentz, could also mean a Galilei symmetry, if you prefer, although I prefer to use Lorentz because we know that's the one that works, and also because it's easier to just send C to infinity whenever you want and find out Galilean symmetry, up to some subtleties. And the spontaneously obvious means that what I want to break spontaneously in particular are the boosts of Lorentz symmetry of Poincaré algebra. And so this means that boosts will be there in the theory, we just non-linearly realized. Now, so this talk is exploring some of the consequences of this very basic observation. Note that somehow this is sort of opposite of another very interesting line of research, which is start out from an obviously Lorentz breaking, explicitly Lorentz breaking systems, such as a bunch of atoms or a crystal, and try to find out Lorentz symmetry in an emergent way. This is also related to the interesting talk by Sergei before in this week. So here I'm taking the opposite point of view. We know that Lorentz, that fundamental physics is Lorentz invariant. I want to find out some possible consequences of having it spontaneously broken in the real world, like in this table, for instance. So this is the outline of my talk. I want to talk about some exact results that you can have basically based on this intuition, in particular a massive Nambu-Goldstone theorem that we formulated with Alberto Nicolis, and then attempt a classification of condensed matter system based on all the possible ways that you can break a boost spontaneously. Obviously, it's a bit there in this. So after an entire week that I hear of extremely sophisticated and interesting condensed matter systems, from Mott insulators to Fermi liquid, non-Fermi liquids. So obviously, it's very naive, this point of view. So I will not arrive to classify all of them, obviously, and only a little part of it. Still, I think this is an interesting point of view, somehow, and that can be improved in directions that I will mention. And can be improved to the point that this point of view also predicts the existence of systems that are not there. So I will also talk about systems that this point of view predicts, and we don't seem to see them in the real world. So let's start with the exact results, in particular this massive Goldstone theorem, which goes back on how I got into this, so from cosmology. And many of you might know, there is a strong indication that there is a primordial phase of acceleration in the universe. And what is typical of this acceleration is that you want the system to be approximately the sitter, and you want the theory behind it to be almost symmetrical. So usually people quote the smallness of these slow roll parameters in suitable units. And the smallness of these slow roll parameters mean anything else than you have an approximate shift symmetry in the system. So in trying to get a universal paradigm for inflation, with Nicolas, we tried to explore the following situation in some detail. We called it a spontaneous symmetry problem. It's extremely simple. It's just that considering time-dependent field configuration. So I'm taking a field configuration that is homogeneous in space and evolving in time. And it's evolving in time in a particularly trivial way, if you want, because it evolves in a symmetry direction. So the time evolution follows a direction in field space that is a symmetry, okay? So in a more formal way, you could see it as considering a state in field theory on which the Hamiltonian acts in the same way or proportionally to an internal charge. So the charge moves the vector towards in a symmetry direction. The Hamiltonian moves it in time. These two combines and gives you zero or a constant, which is the same, times the same vector. So obviously you can redub this new sort of operator as a new Hamiltonian of the system. Obviously, in order for this to represent this situation, also mu must break q, so that q acting on mu doesn't give mu again, gives something else, and the system moves. Okay, so but this is nothing else. So this is precisely the same formalism as we discovered. It took long for me, but it was in principle quite easy. This is the same formalism of what you use for systems at finite charge density. If you put a system at a finite charge density, especially if the charge that you are putting at finite density is breaking if the system itself breaks the symmetry of the corresponding to the charge that you're putting at finite density, then you might want to classify the the excitations upon the vacuum with this new non-relativistic Hamiltonian. Just because if the state is not an eigenstate of Q, is not an eigenstate of H either, because we know that H minus mu Q gives zero on the state. So it's better to just classify the excitations on top of these systems with this non-relativistic Hamiltonian, which is non-relativistic obviously because it contains a pure relativistic piece plus something that is proportional to the zero component of a charge. So as we know, a condensed matter system breaks Lorentz symmetry, but breaks it, and in this case it's particularly easy to see if you want, breaks it obviously spontaneously. I'm saying that the theory is still H, all relativistic fields still evolve with H, it's just easier to describe the small excitations on top of this system with this other Hamiltonian. Okay, so we are trading, if you want, we are trading an explicit breaking of Lorentz symmetry in this case with a spontaneous breaking. And on top of it, it would be an apparently this is also an explicit breaking of all the charges that do not commute with Q, because if you have a bunch of charges that would commute with H but not with Q, now all these charges will not commute with this new Hamiltonian that you created. But again, it's a sort of a spontaneous breaking of all these symmetries, not explicit. The state breaks them, not the dynamics. So before I'm going to the details of this Goldstone theorem that we proved, let me just summarize the usual case. So this is just the usual Goldstone theorem, and for demonstrated in the most general ways with Brahe and Ketz. So usually you start with this by considering a matrix element of this form. So this is the charge that it's broken and that at will end will interpolate your Goldstone field. So in the Heisenberg picture, this charge is time dependent, obviously. And then you consider some field operator, local field operator, some order parameter that is broken by the symmetry. So we consider it at some point in space, some specific point in space that could as well be the origin. Now this guy is constant just because of the conservation of the charge. More subtly, you can prove this rigorously if the charge is also an integral of a current. Obviously, this piece can be made arbitrarily. It can go to zero if I integrate a volume outside the light cone, and then this will be strictly zero. Okay, which means that by this strictly zero means that this will be a constant. But then, of course, it could be zero too. But the statement of symmetry breaking is that this is not zero, so it's constant, and this is not zero, meaning that this order parameter will be shifted by the vacuum expectation value of this order parameter will be shifted by the symmetry. Okay, so after some manipulation, considering this matrix element, you express this charge as an integral of a current. You consider this current at a whatever space-time point, and you express this value of the current with evolution operators. So you rephrase it as current in zero times these evolution operators that they act on the vacuum and on the states on the right. On the right, I put a completeness of states, meaning many species n at whatever momenta, but then there is a delta function that comes out in the process. So what I end up is that this matrix element is, you can prove that it is written as in this form. Now, here are a bunch of intermediate state that are calculated at zero momentum, and I isolated all the possible time dependence in this T. So everything here is time independent. I know that it must be time independent. So in order for this to be zero, I need and not sorry, in order for this to be constant and not zero, I need this the energy of at least one of these states at zero momentum to be itself zero. Not that you can say, okay, but in the completion, in the complete set of state, I will have also the vacuum. Okay, but if you put the vacuum here, minus complex conjugate will give you zero, while you want something different from zero. Okay, so this is the usual Goldstone theorem. And since you on the top of it, say, beside telling you that there are states, a bunch of state of that go that have zero energy in the limit of zero momenta, so are massless states. It is also implicitly telling you that both the charge, the current, and this broken order parameter interpolate the states of the vacuum, meaning that this will contain some A dagger of this field that acting on the vacuum will produce this field. Okay? Okay, so now how does it apply to systems at finite charge? So here I want to.
Good question. There we go. When you say said that you will insert there a point that will give you non-zero. Essentially, only point at zero momentum will be giving you non-zero in the way you want. But that is essentially the same as vacuum.
No, because a vacuum here would give you zero because...
What will give you non-zero?
No, because there is minus CC. So there is minus focus conjugate.
Which contribution will give you non-zero? In order to have the whole result non-zero, what can give you non-zero?
Sure, there must be a state different from the vacuum of zero energy.
With one point, for example, right?
Yes.
But that point must also have zero or non-zero momentum. If it's zero momentum, it's not distinguishable from vacuum.
No, it is, of course. It's not a state. It's a one pion in the universe with zero momentum.
So like a press, right? Well, I'm trying to understand what kind of one pion state, for example, can give you this non-zero, because if it's a massless pion at zero momentum, essentially it cannot exist.
Sure, it can.
You should probably enclose the system in pion volume, therefore you'll see that this argument enforces that there's an excitation range whose energy goes to zero with momentum. It's not just one isolated state.
Yeah, you can regularize this in a finite volume.
Or alternatively, you can do just write the spectral representation and find that the spectral density must have a delta function, delta function distribution at omega equals zero. So,
I mean, this is in like the tower of states. So,
it's quite yeah. But let's say this is a rigorous proof beyond the also very. Nice effective Lagrangian methods, which I will also mention in the following. So what changes now if I am at a finite charge density? So now I want to, so the ingredients are basically two, as I said before. I want to calculate the spectrum, to study the spectrum of this other Hamiltonian, which on my state at finite density gives zero, in the presence possibly of a bunch of conserved charges, which will belong to some symmetry group. Now, I call the Q1 the charge that I'm putting at a zero charge, and then I will have Q2, Q3, etc. Then I will have, now here is the role of H bar, if you want, but then there is another role played as usual by H, which is every conserved current evolves in time and space, with the Poincaré, operators. So every current evolves with H, not with H bar. Okay, so this will be used in the demonstration. So I can write whatever current at whatever position as current in zero acted upon by these evolutor operators, and the final result is that. All the currents which are broken and do not commute with Q will give a massive ghostons whose mass is exactly calculable in the theory. So no radiative corrections, it's an exact result in field theory. So how does it work? So I proceed as before. I consider a matrix element as before, this time in bracketed between the state as zero density. And I consider one of these charges, okay? So once again, this must be zero. This must be constant, but not zero for the reasons that I said before. This is a broken charge. This has to be different from zero. And after some manipulation, you obtain something similar as before, except that now the time dependence appears explicitly here as before, and also in this operator. Now, you see the difference. So before, whenever I had the charge, it hitted on the vacuum. Before, whenever I had the Hamiltonian, it hitted on the vacuum and it gives a zero. This time, the relativistic Hamiltonian hits on this state and gives you mu Q, because we know that the action of the Hamiltonian is the same as the action of mu times Q on the state. So I find not a J zero, but this combination of operators. Now, what is this combination of operators? Well, let's say that the symmetry algebra is characterized by some structure constants. So you can find out that this operator you can write it as a time dependent combination of conserved charges. So I'm saying that the time evolution of this is somewhat trivial. So it's just the time evolution, a time dependent combination of charges. Okay. Now, this is the exponent of a matrix that is F1 BC. So I'm leaving the indices BC free. It's anti-symmetric. I can put it in normal form, in a block diagonal form of this type. And then I will find that time evolutor operator mixes together only couples of conserved charges, okay? All the other terms are zero. Now, then you plug it back in here, and you find that in order for this guy to exactly cancel the time dependence that is given from here, E must be, so the energy of of the state at zero momentum must be precisely the chemical potential mu times this Q alpha being one of those guys that appeared here in the block diagonal components. So again, to summarize, one might say, okay, I'm starting from an Hamiltonian, which is not the original Hamiltonian H. Obviously, since I'm adding here a charge, obviously all the charges that do not commute with Q will not commute with the H bar anymore. So I expect to have pseudo Gostown bosons with masses of order of mu. Here I'm saying something more, if you want. I'm saying that the mass is not of order mu, is precisely this number, okay? So just to give you some examples, so this is you can consider a vector SO3 model. So here we have three fields, phi 1, phi 2, phi 3, and I can decide to turn on a charge in the three direction, in the phi three directions. So for this purpose, I will go into a radial and angular coordinates for the phi one and phi two directions. So the radial is this sigma, and the angular is this theta. M square, you might want to consider it negative. So this potential already breaks the symmetry even at zero chemical potential, but it's not necessary. In fact, you can have a breaking of the symmetry just by turning up the velocity of rotation of these guys. But anyway, so this is the effective Lagrangian, and so you want to consider it around a SSP solution. So here you do, in a sense, what we do every day in cosmological perturbation theory. You're not breaking explicitly any symmetry. You just consider perturbations around not a symmetry, not a Lorentz invariant configuration. So here is the background solution, if you want. You calculate the perturbations and you find that phi 3 gets some. So sorry, here mu became c. I'm sorry about that because it's another slice. But the field phi 3 acquires a mass of order, acquires precisely the mass mu, which is c here, sorry. But then you can build up other examples. For instance, you can break SO3 in a different way with another realization. You can consider symmetric traceless matrices. And here you find that you can again make the answers of a spontaneously symmetry probing solution of this type. And in this case, you find one Gostown with the predicted mass, but you also find an unfixed gap Goldstone, meaning that this mass is just of order mu, but it's not better specified. So obviously here there is a difference with the case before, because before we had a system that has zero chemical potential, broke SU3 into U1, okay? And then you may think, okay, I turn on a little chemical potential, I had two Goldstones, one remains linear, although non-relativistic, and was the theta direction here. You see here, you had I called it here pi, but so this is the Goldstone that becomes massless. However, it will become also non-relativistic because when you integrate out this piece, the heavy field would give an effective speed of sound to this guy. Now here I have SO3 that at zero chemical potential is broken into nothing. So I have three Goldstones. So what happens here is that one acquires the fixed gap predicted by the theorem, and the other two become one massive and one linear non-relativistic. Okay, so this is more or less what happened. So in order to study this type of examples in more detail, we also with Ricardo and Rachel, we made a systematic coset construction of what can happen at finite density. So here is the scheme. We have a full symmetry group of charges. We will have some unbroken charges, TA, and some broken charges, okay? So the charges that I put at finite density, since I want to preserve these two requirements that are useful for the formalism, will in generally be written as a combination of a broken charge and of an unbroken charge, okay? So, I will use the coset construction that Solomon talked about yesterday, and where the unbroken generators are the Hamiltonian, the non-relativistic Hamiltonian I was telling you before, normal translations, normal relativistic translations, and rotations, and these charges that we. These internal charges. While here you have these charges that are broken, Q itself is broken, obviously, and boosts are also broken. Now, so the coset construction being boils down to write down these Mourier-Cartan. So to parameterize the coset in the first place with the broken generators. I strongly refer to again to Salomon's talk yesterday for this, and in this case, for simplicity, we will always apply the so-called inverse Higgs constraint, meaning that the Goldstones related to the boosts can be get rid of by applying the inverse X constraint. Obviously, also in the previous case, the one at with the if I consider a field that acquires a vacuum expectation value that is evolving in time, I'm also breaking boost. But obviously, I don't have this boost around because I have only one field, so I don't have enough degrees of freedom for having boost. So it is consistent to consider that there are no Goldstones related to the broken boosts. And so let's start with I want to consider broken charges, and these broken charges will split into two branches. Either they are commuting with Q, in this case, this commutator will just give zero here, okay? Or they are not. And in this case, again, you can set, you can find a particularly convenient basis in which this matrix here can be expressed in block diagonal form as follows, okay? So basically, whenever this is not commuting, this is another Higgs constraint that you can impose because yeah, you see that you have since Q does not commute with the XA, Q is also contained in the unbroken generator. So the formula for the inverse SIGs is if you have some unbroken generator mu that commutes that doesn't come whose commutator with some q prime gives you some other q, then you can get rid of the Goldstones related to q prime, because you know that in the equations of motions of in the expression of the covariant derivative of this Goldstone, there will be a piece of the type pi equals the pi plus the Goldstone of this charge. So you can express every time you write in your effective Lagrangian and you find this Goldstone, you can substitute and write it as a you can impose this you can set this to zero and write it as a through the derivatives of this other Goldstone. So basically here it's up to you to see to decide whether or not you want to get rid of one of the two potentially massive Goldstones that you have here. And we saw that there are different examples brings you to different realization. For instance, the vector SO3 model doesn't have the other Goldstone, and you just have why is it bothering me with this? So in the example, in the vector SO3 example of before, you didn't have this other Goldstone, so implicitly the inverse SIGs constraint was applied. In the other example, there was another Goldstone, so the inverse SIGs constraint was not applied. So what you can say is that these other massive Goldstones, which are not whose mass is not fixed by the symmetry, and it's still of order of the chemical potential, are always no more than the fixed mass gapped Goldstones. Okay. Okay. So then, yes. So this is what I said here for this an option not fixed. Then of course there are the commuting the Goldstones that commute so relative to broken generators which do commute with Q. Again in the you can write down the effective Lagrangian and you find that the relevant term is of this type. So they appear with only one time derivative acting upon them, same structure. Will be some zero pieces and some non-zero pieces. No? So now, all the zero pieces gives you linear dispersion relations. All non-zero pieces, this time there is no possible inverse SIGs to apply. So all each one of these will give you one massless quadratic Goldstone and one gapped Goldstone. Okay. Again, not of not fixed mass and of order mu. So this is related to something that also Hitoshi talked about during the week.
Why do you call this one Goldstone
bosons? Because they are pseudo Goldstone bosons. Yes.
So do I get it right that that for every Goldstone boson with quadratic dispersion relation, there is a massive Goldstone boson. Is it what you are saying? No.
Yes, but only in this case. So only related to those generators that commute with the charge that you put at finite density. In fact, so this is precisely helps me summarizing. So what I'm saying is that the unfixed gap can come either from the commuting sector and the non-commuting sector. So in the non-commuting sector, you have as many as in the commuting sector, you have as many as
So in ferromagnet, you have the quadratic Goldstone, and there is no gapped part of it. It's just one mode.
But isn't that because the would-be partner is just has a mass that is the owner of the cutoff.
No, so. Okay, would-be partner doesn't exist. So if a ground state jar aligns spins, there's an unbroken U1 charge in the ground state of the ferromagnet. And the magnet, the Bernoulli goldstone carries a charge of this unbroken U1,
mm-hmm.
which corresponds to like flipping one of the spins.
Okay.
But since the ground state already has maximum speed, the partner would correspond to the opposite charge. Such a state doesn't exist.
But certainly it's possible to add higher derivative terms to make that more complicated. Just like if I have first order kinetic terms and I add a second order kinetic term.
The only level of averaging you can make it possible, just saying concrete systems. I think especially if you have
just means that you can't distinguish it from like lattice curvature.
Yeah, you can have a partially polarized term.
So but then the technical reason for this is that this structure is no longer true, basically. So when I write down the effective Lagrangian and the system is not relativistic to begin with, this is not, you can have generalization of all this structure.
Sorry.
Yes.
I'm trying to understand your table. You had a table picture. So that's a high density matrix system, lots of electrons and lots of protons, it's neutral. Then once you localize a table, it supports Goldstone mode, namely phonons. Now, in your picture, where is it appearing? I'm trying to understand.
Sure.
So you have.
Yes, so typically, so, okay, so let's say.
And also the sound velocity is different from velocity of light.
Sure.
How will it
affect
that?
So these are. This, you see it because, so here I added to the charge that I put at finite density. For instance, let's consider a superfluid. So superfluid has one charge, the particle number, and the phonon you are talking about is here, is the Goldstone of the charge, of that broken charge. This charge is broken, and this is precisely the phonon of the superfluid.
There is no need that it should be velocity of light.
There's no need because all that this is saying is that this is linear. So what is missing here is the order of magnitude of this velocity, if you want, because when you write down an effective Lagrangian, you could put whatever number between 0 and 1 in natural units, right? So why is this velocity so small with respect to the speed of light? Obviously, this naive picture cannot give it to you, so you need perhaps to give more information on the peculiarities of the system. Now, and then all the other Goldstones that I'm talking about here are Goldstones on top of this one and on top of the charges that I'm putting at finite density. So here is the summary. Again, so unfixed Goldstones can come from both sectors, but I have one fixed gap from every non-commuting charge, for every pair of non-commuting charges, I would say, and then from the commuting sector, I also have a massless quadratic and massless linear, and it is easy to see that. From their origin, it is easy to see that this number have to satisfy this inequality. So now let me go to the other part of my talk, and final somewhat. So the naive classification of condensed matter systems. So let's take seriously this idea that a condensed matter system comes from a relativistic theory that is spontaneously broken. So let's start from the full symmetry Poincaré group made of translation, rotations, and boosts that will satisfy the usual commutation relations. I just write one in here. And let's apply also a certain number of internal symmetries to this system, okay? So now I know that in my condensed matter system, I want to describe the excitations of this condensed matter system. And these excitations will be invariant. Well, approximately only under translations and rotations, obviously, will not be invariant under boost because the system picks up a preferred frame. However, obviously, this operator doesn't need to be the same as this one, same for rotation. So if you want, this naive classification of condensed matter system boils down into asking, in how many ways can I, in equivalent ways, can I break boosts spontaneously? And having effective translations and rotation operators in my condensed matter systems. Yes. No.
But condensed matter systems do that, yeah? In condensed matter case, this is not ground state which breaks. This is, from the point of view of relativistic theory, this is a special and some state of the system, yeah? Which is actually
sure.
Characterized by non-vanishing chemical potentials. Yeah, that's essential.
So the relation is not strict. So, for instance, a crystal is, to a very good approximation, an eigenstate of QED. Is it a state with a finite chemical potential? I'm not sure. It's
yes, barium charges, not zero.
Yeah. And left.
It's not only electric chemical potential. There are others.
So you say finite chemical potential, but the number is not broken. So it's a fixed number of particles.
Breaks each other, so adding particle would not cost energy, you know. So I don't necessarily have any breaks.
What kind of condensed matter background you can imagine which doesn't have a chemical potential? You always have some background, some crystal.
No, I'm not saying that you can fine tune the system to zero chemical potential.
Now that's not from the point of view of relativism. That's different chemical potential. We are talking about the condensed matter chemical potential, which is the difference.
I think I have an answer to your question,
What about a fluid of photons? No conservative charge there.
For
laser, you'll have to define chemical potential. Suppose you have a laser, which is a fluid of photons. Depending on amplitude, it's
exactly.
Then
exactly.
You can
exactly. Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So,
might it be useful to just think about a sector of the Hilbert space with fixed charge?
Let me go on. I think I have an answer to your question. At some point, I will put it in. Okay, then of course, obviously, these translations and rotations inside the condensed matter system will have to satisfy the usual commutation relations between each other. Now, a possible improvement of the scheme would be considering discrete versions of these. So either discrete translations, although at very long wavelength, they should be not very important, or discrete rotations, okay? So we have not considered it here. Now we want to define these as strictly satisfying the usual commutation relations of the Poincaré symmetry. And now you can try.
Can you express it in terms of the original ones, or you just
precisely? The game is this. So the game is expressing these in different ways through the original ones plus possibly conserved charges, internal symmetries. Okay, and the first example is the superfluid once again. So this time translations are the original ones, rotations are the original ones. H bar is H minus mu Q. Now, probably it is true that mu Q is always there, but if Q is not broken, it just reshifts the zero of the energy. So every time Q is not broken, let me use H directly instead of H bar. Mm-hmm. okay? So whenever you see H bar equal SH, think, okay, this is just an unbroken, okay. So in this case, you just need an internal symmetry U1. You describe superfluids, you know. You have one ghost, and you can think this as an order parameter, a symmetry breaking order parameter, as a scalar field that breaks that acquires a vacuum expectation values proportional to T. Okay. Then they've been touched upon during this workshop. Solids. So there is this formal way of describing solids by saying that both rotations and translations are spontaneously broken. Obviously, you don't have six Goldstones because you apply again the inverse six to the Goldstones belonging to rotations. So in this case, you need an internal symmetry that is the Euclidean group. So this big Q and small Q have to close an algebra, the same algebra that P and J close. And again, you can play a very similar game. And this is like having fields acquiring expectation values proportional to the coordinates. Then you can also have fluids if on top of these symmetries you impose another symmetry, which is invariance under, you impose that the Lagrangian doesn't change if you transform these field quantities in a way that preserves the determinant, meaning that the fluid will not change its energy if you just move around the particles. Then you can go on and say, okay, so let's instead play again that all these parameters are different from the original ones. So H will need a U1, an internal U1, and these two will need an internal Euclidean group. And again, you have systems realized in nature, if I understand, super solids, four Goldstones, and this is the symmetry breaking pattern. Okay, so but can we have, for instance, this part? So I should tell you something. The details of this classification have been worked out inside the collaboration by Riccardo, so I should absolutely acknowledge his important work here. So can we have this pattern, meaning I'm changing the the translations without changing the rotations? So this cannot be done with an internal symmetry because this QI needs to have these commutation properties with the rotations. So there are different ways to obtain these. But so the simplest one is this. So is using Galilean symmetry to do this. So this QI will belong to a multiplate, which is in fact a vector Q mu. And these are the Galilean charges. And you can think this as a system that acquires a vacuum expectation value that not only is proportional to x, but it's quadratically growing with x. Now, but in Galilean theories, because Galilean symmetry contains a term that is proportional to to the coordinates, you can reabsorb this space dependence by using a symmetry of the theory. So similarly, you can now add a Q component to H and define these type 2 Galileids if you want, where now the vacuum expectation value is of this form. Again, with a transformation of this type, you can reabsorb it and put it to zero. And but what about the simplest option when literally every Poincaré generator is also the unbroken generators of your condensed matter system? Well, this is so this time I cannot get rid of the Goldstones of the boosts. Actually, the Goldstones of the boosts are the only one left. So I will have three Goldstones. And we call this system type 1 frames just because they seem to be related to just to the choice of the frame and to nothing else, to no other internal charge. And you can think about them as a four-dimensional vector field acquiring a vacuum expectation values in the t direction. Okay. I will go back to this later. Then there are other few options. So then you can say, okay, what if I just apply this to rotations, to framings, and rotations and H at the same time. So for this, I will need an internal symmetry S of three times U1, and this. As Solomon was saying yesterday briefly, resembles a little bit the symmetry breaking pattern of helium 3 in its B phase. So maybe there are chances that this is indeed realized. And it's curious, nothing. So let me go back to frames and to what I call the type 1 frames that do not break any other symmetry than boosts themselves. So indeed, the naive analysis saying, okay, so let me start from the order parameter that gets a VEV, this vector field here. Let me parameterize it with boosts applied to the unit vector, and let me write down a Lagrangian with two derivatives for this guy. So you obtain the same results that you would obtain with the nicer coset constructions, where you write the Lagrangian directly in terms of the Goldstones. And this is the quadratic Lagrangian. You have a vector field that decomposes into a longitudinal and transverse part. Now, the nice thing is that L3 and L4 at lowest order in derivatives are completely determined by CL and CT. So CL, the speed of sound of the longitudinal mode and on the transverse modes of these guys fixes also the lowest derivative interactions. And since this is the same number of bosons that you have in solids, you may ask, okay, so are these just solids? So in solids, you have three phonons. Now, the point is that they are not, so they are really a different system. And you can see it also from the scaling of the Lagrangian of the boson. So the solids always contain one derivative per field. Here, at lowest order in derivative, you have interactions with four fields and two derivatives. And you can also calculate explicitly scattering amplitudes just to be sure that there are no cancellations spurious cancellation, and you in fact see that the scattering amplitude grows at low energy as the energy squared itself, while for solids it is known to grow as a to the fourth, as this naive scaling would suggest. So why they are not around us? Why we are not surrounded by framings? So one possible explanation is that so when playing this game of building an unbroken Poincaré generator from the original one plus symmetries, I always had the choice of inserting a parameter, the chemical potential, for instance, or other parameters, just to balance. So these parameters were set to one in most of my examples, but in fact they're there, okay? So here you should consider, here you have a mu, so there is a parameter. So, and this parameter somewhat seems to relate the system to the underlying thermodynamics. So it's typically some thermodynamical parameter that you can adjust in the real world just by changing boundary condition of your system. So since condensed matter systems are made of stuff, maybe framings are not around because they don't seem to be made of stuff. So you cannot change them. You cannot. So this is a very naive picture. But this is also, you can also see it from the point of view. Made of atoms. Let's say made of atoms. Yeah. Let's be technical. We are at a physics conference. Yes. Yes. Sorry. but So, and you can see it also explicitly from the effective theory. So usually these parameters do not need to appear explicitly in the effective theory, but also the way the effective theory is built, so you write down the Lagrangian for the Goldstones or the Fremds, and you try to say, okay, let's calculate Tmu nu, and let's try to impose that these Goldstones form a Tmu nu that is a constant, is homogeneous, meaning that I want to compress my fluid or my system, and I want him to react by giving an homogeneous pressure or a homogeneous density. So this is not this seems not to be to be allowed just by the form of the Lagrangian. If you try to insert these ansatz on some field configuration, there is no such field configuration that allows these ansatz. This is preliminary, but this seems to be the case. So. I finished my classification.
I'm still confused about the notion that the frames don't exist because they cannot be made of stuff. Yeah, but as you discussed previously, you can add a chemical potential there. There might be
precisely. They're not frames anymore.
No, but why? What's wrong if I just add to the system? Or just by definition.
So if I had, so if in this trick I had a chemical potential, which to be meaningful would mean that Q has to be broken. I'm describing so once you.
Is the number broken by electric system?
Well, it's an eigenstate, no, of the numbers.
It's an eigenstate, yeah. So
it's not, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that.
It's not broken.
Yeah.
Okay, then you can have the
same. But yes, you can play something similar, but it's a different symmetry breaking pattern. You might say, okay, let me have the same stuff here, but just with this modification, okay?
Yeah.
Very good. Okay. So with this modification, I'm allowed to apply the inverse Higgs constraint. So get rid of all my degrees of freedom here and be left with the superfluid. Okay. I may also not apply the inverse Higgs constraint. In this case, I will describe a system of a complex vector field. So that, for instance, acquires a vacuum expectation values of the type e to the I mu T delta mu I, okay? This maybe have more chances to be realized in nature, but strictly is not the symmetry breaking pattern I'm referring to now. So, and finally, back to cosmology. This is my last slide. So a direction that I find intriguing is that, so this is where I came from also, no? At the beginning of the talk. And so that all the different realizations of inflation and dark energy on the market seems to have big resemblances with this, just because you want a field that spontaneously breaks boosts. Okay, so in cosmology, boosts are spontaneously broken by the preferred reference frame of the CMB. So my guess is that this analogy between condensed matter and modified gravity goes beyond these examples that I wrote here. And perhaps, yes. So, yes, so it would be interesting to accelerate the universe with a cuprate or something. Thank you.
One example kept coming to my mind. This is a case of quantum Heisenberg antiferromagnet. So with full spin symmetry, you can take a cubic lattice and put spin half moments. Now, the ground state for a finite system containing even number of spins is supposed to be a singlet. There are theorems. But however, when the system becomes very large, there are so-called Anderson Tower of excited states, which tell you about the pattern of symmetry breaking that will happen here, namely the simple two sublattice antiferromagnet. So you can also recover whole stone modes from this Anderson travel. But however, there is another thing, namely you can apply external magnetic field and basically go to the excited state of this original Hamilton. That is, you create a finite spin polarization and then look at things there. So that field commutes with the full Hamiltonian. Now, if Lorentz symmetry, as you say, is spontaneously broken, there should be some special Hamiltonian governing the universe, like the quantum Heisenberg antiferromagnet, which tries to break Lorentz symmetry spontaneously. So the vacuum will be fully Lorentz. But however, there must be some whole stone modes or Anderson traverse present, indicating the possibility of this spontaneous symmetry. And what are they in your mind?
Sorry.
Because
your SO3, are, what are they?
In your mind.
Ah.
Because you gave an SO3 example. To me, this quantum antiferromagnet is a slightly better example, because the vacuum has the full SU2 symmetry, or in your language, Lorentz symmetry.
Okay.
Then there are some special tower of excitations of this universe, which indicates possibility of this spontaneous symmetry of Lorentz symmetry. So do you have, I don't know, I'm talking too much. But
No. It's I can just make a general statement. So I don't know. I'm too ignorant. So the general statement is that since fundamental theories are Lorentz invariant, every condensed matter should be a spontaneously broken phase of them. But then, obviously, the actual way it is, it could be very mysterious. It could require many steps. It's not obvious to how to recognize your ghost on from QED, for instance. I don't know where they are in QED, but there will be some. So they are contained in QED for sure. I mean, there's nothing. No.
So one more point is, while magnetic field commutes the Zeeman term commutes to the Hamiltonian, the antiferromagnetic order that emerges after the spontaneous symmetry breaking, that operator doesn't commute to the Hamiltonian. So that's a very important point. So I don't.
That's very cool. Yes. So
that.
So you're saying that yes. So it would be interesting to consider external configurations that in which also some translations, for instance, in which there is a preferred direction.
For example, this table
is
a wave packet in some sense. It will take astronomically long time for this wave packet to evolve. So it's not a conserved quantity if you think in terms of the original Lagrangian. The state of this is not an eigenstate.
Yes.
So I think that's a lesson one learns from this quantum antiferromagnet example that Anderson gave. The ground state is a singlet, but however, you can form wave packets even for a 100 spin system. And then if you look at the time taken for this wave packet to spread, it would be astronomical time.
I need you to teach me better these things, because they look very interesting, but.
It's between the, so you're mentioning cosmology, but you can think of the Bianchi types as a way of classifying the symmetry of Robertson-Walker metrics. Is there a mapping to your...
Yes, that would be the next step, I would say.
Picking generators and then, asking...
Yes, so this is a... this could be also interesting. So, for instance, I mentioned briefly that... possibly an improvement of this would be considering, I'm getting too far, so non-broken combinations of these that are discrete, or this might want to single out preferred directions, and then of course you would have the cosmological correspondent of this would be, I think, a Bianchi type. Yes. I guess rotations should be broken down to some group like since you have preferred directions, you only can do like 90 degrees rotations or something like this. You know, I would say.
Can you go back to the slide where you were proving the nodal solve theorem?
I didn't really remember.
I have a question that's also related to this discussion of what exactly the role of the Lorentz boosts.
Yes.
In convex matter systems. Maybe the previous one, so the usual boosts.
Okay.
There was this commutator which vanishes, you know, which whose expectation value is a certain term.
Okay.
The previous one.
All right. Yes. Right. Yes.
Use causality to get rid of this, of that surface term, right?
Yes.
But you know, in convex matter systems, there are no examples of the system where if you have a long range interaction, it invalidates the proof of the Goldstone theorem. If this term doesn't vanish, as a result of which the would-be Goldstone gets a gap, like a Poisson oscillation in Bloomberg systems. So where does your argument go wrong in these examples?
Well, here.
Well, but you know, you could always say that the underlying theory is QED, or you have causality, right? So why? I think, if I may,
sure.
Yes, I think the problem is that the boosts are spontaneously broken, and so they are not realized by unitary operators on the Hilbert space. So the usual argument leading to the vanishing of the expected of the commutator outside the light cone. Simply,
well,
okay.
There's a second factor, just that in the effective field theory where this argument is invalidated, you've integrated out some things.
Yeah.
So
there might not be any local spaces theories.
So you're saying, if you start from a relativistic point of view, your analysis is wrong because you would predict a ghost. In fact, there is not, because
from a relativistic point of view, this term should always vanish because of causality. Spontaneous broken symmetry. There was long ago, there was this discussion about the non-relativistic.
Yeah, I'm aware of
this.
I'm aware of this.
About it initially, because there turned out to be other examples which have to do with the existence of long-range forces in the system. And this term doesn't vanish. So somehow, when you go down from the QED scale, something happens which invalidates just naive application of the boost.
The plasma oscillation is not like moving all of the matter, it's moving electrons relative to the ions. That's why it costs a lot of energy. If you move the entire thing, it's a sound wave, and that costs no energy. I think it's not a contradiction. Like, just moving one part of the charge is not.
Maybe
never
I use the term plasma oscillation due to my ignorance of Bonnet Bell.
No, you used it exactly correctly. I mean, you said I oscillate the charge density.
Okay.
So I have the ions like anchored in my vibes in my lab. And the electron fluid can oscillate, but you can't, you know, move it. If you make a charge density, then you get a lot of energy.
Yeah, right. I'm not.
But that's not a global
force.
Motion of the whole system, right? So it doesn't seem
like that's a different thing. For some ways, yes.
No, the question is, what is the broken symmetry in that case? What is the potentially broken?
I was thinking of U1. Internal U1.
Potentially broken in that case. Again, I would rather say that there is a chemical potential for U1 in plasma, but is this potentially broken?
If you think of just some, you know, fermionic pairing model, which is a contact interaction, which is a U1 that you break spontaneously, the long range interaction, that you won't have any ghost control.
But in a metal that supports plasma oscillation, no U1 symmetry is broken. The standard, you know, if you take copper, there will be plasma oscillations. And it's not a consequence of your right long range interaction gaps in plasma.
Translations.
No, translations are they're still gaps.
You can just take an internal symmetry, just particle number, which is broken.
No, in the case of superconductors, that's a separate issue.
Yeah, yeah.
Suppose
yeah,
I have a superconductor, then you can identify plasma with the gap there. Wollaston modes.
Right.
But even without superconductivity, the metal supports the same plasma, which is gap. So that is due to long breaking patch. But there is no underlying symmetry breaking necessary to reduce that.
Yeah, I have a quick question about the boundaries. Can you modify this construction to describe something like a homogeneous, mostly everything was homogeneous, so basically just the simplest inhomogeneity, a boundary between two regions of space with some symmetry breaking, so let's say vacuum and some non-trivial condensed matter. Is it possible to generalize this construction in that case?
It will. I think it would lose its allure. Allure. How do you say in English? No, in the sense that so. So these are finite volume effects that obviously, if you are fine enough, you will see and you will be able to describe. But the zeroth order description is this. So obviously you're putting yourself in, you're considering excitations that are typically of wavelength much bigger than the interatomic size and much shorter than the volume. Of course,
I'm not violating that. You could easily probably construct a system where you take a point like defect and see what's happening in that case. In this case, it's not point like it's a...
I see. So again, I think this could boil down to trying to generalize it, and I think it might be needed at some point if you want to find out other condensed matter systems. So playing with the discreteness somewhat of the translations, I don't know. This could be also interesting. But
yeah, I'm not sure. It's a bit difficult to implement within the Cosette construction, because if you have, let's say, this boundary, then the boundaries are saying breaks translations perpendicular to the so in general what you get from the Cosette construction is a field theory that lives in the same number of dimension as the number of unbroken translations. So using the Cosette you can describe excitations of this surface, like the riplons that Toshi was talking about, but I think yeah, so you can describe that, or you can pretend to be at scales much smaller and be deep in the bulk and describe excitations in the bulk using these. Yeah.
Thanks, Federico.
Thank you.